Welcome to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Rogue Startups Podcast. This week I have on Marcus Taylor. Marcus may be someone that most folks know in the audience. He's kind of the founder of Venture Harbor. And I guess their flagship product is called Lead Formally. But Marcus, how are you doing?
Yeah, great. Thank you. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks. You know, Marcus, I guess we connected, 6 or 8 weeks ago, as I've been kind of on this this quest and kind of a personal mission to kind of rise above a lot of the day-to-day stuff in my business and kind of give the business the opportunity to go to the next level and me not hold it back a lot. And so I found a lot of the stuff that you talk about and write about with, I guess, both running Venture Harbor and Lead Formally as really appealing. But for folks who don't know who you are or kind of what you're up to, can you kind of give some background on that for everybody?
Sure. So I run a company called Venture Harbor. Venture Harbor is kind of a funny company because Venture Harbor doesn't really provide any service or product per se. Venture Harbor purely exists to build ventures. And so we run currently 9 different ventures, Lead Formally being one of them. Lead Formally is a lead generation software company that we built to help companies increase their conversion rates of their lead forms. But we also have financial comparison sites and sites that have run sort of AI chatbots, all these different ventures. And so Venture Hub was really kind of an extension of, I realized that I didn't really like having a boss. I didn't really like working for someone else. And I wanted to have this kind of this sandbox that enabled me to explore different ideas, run experiments, and build products that I thought would be interesting. And so Venture Hub is basically that. It's basically just my sandbox for building interesting companies that I want to build.
Gotcha. And is it just yourself there at Venture Harbor? I mean, I know at this point you have kind of a team, but are there other founders or equity owners?
So Venture Harbor is a small team. We have 5 of us that are kind of employed by Venture Harbor, if you like. Then we have quite a significant team beyond that of contractors. I think last time I checked, it was about 30 different contractors around the world, mostly developers. That help to kind of build and develop all the ventures. In terms of the equity side of things, the vast majority of ventures I own 100% of, completely privately owned. We don't have any investors for any of the ventures. So everything is, bar a few ventures that might, some of them are joint ventures, everything has been self-funded. So the success of early ventures paid for the development of the following ventures. And it's just been this kind of snowball effect of, you know, we've reached a certain point where we're now able to invest a certain chunk of annual revenue into just exploring new ideas and building these new products.
Gotcha. I love it. I love this model. This is the model that I personally am working towards, is having a portfolio of different types of companies. Currently, I have a service business in podcasting. I have a podcast hosting business, as well as have just acquired a very small kind of referral or affiliate management tool. And so I'm kind of on my way, I guess, to building a little mini Craig industrial empire of online services and tools. But, you know, the thing that I like this a lot because it diversifies your risk a little bit. But what I'm seeing is it also diversifies your ability to focus. And I think that's the obvious kind of negative of having multiple things going on at one time. How have you you said 6, 7, or 8, 9 different things you have going on. How have you been able to focus on high value things that you yourself do for your businesses every day?
Yeah. So it's the blessing and curse with this model, right? Like it's great, as you mentioned, from a diversification perspective. And it's also great from I'd say one of the biggest benefits with this model is the kind of the cross-pollination, for lack of a better way of putting it, of the ideas that we discover in one venture, we then can kind of apply that across 7, 8 other ventures. And so there's this really nice thing of kind of the learnings that we're getting from each venture, tend to be universal and able to make everything grow faster. But you've touched on a really interesting point, which is something I still kind of battle with to this day, which is the idea of focus and how do you, when you have all of these different ventures, how do you sort of make sure that you're not just kind of pushing along lots of things, like tweaking a lot of things, but you're still making a lot of progress in each of them. And for me, I guess we have a rule, which is we expect when we build a venture that we will leave it alone for at least 12 months at any given time. And so in order for that to make sense and for the venture to still grow, knowing that at some point we will probably leave it alone and do nothing to it for 12 months, we have this concept at Venture Harbor called growth on autopilot. So at first we were trying to reach this point of running on autopilot, which we sort of define running on autopilot as you can leave it alone for 12 months and it will be the same as where you left it. Whereas the concept that we have of growth on autopilot is that you should be able to leave a project or a venture alone for 12 months and come back and find it bigger and more successful than when you left it. So we spend a lot of time thinking about how do we build systems and automate, particularly marketing and sales, so that we create this kind of self-regulating marketing system that gets better over time. So without going, you know, too much into the sort of the nitty-gritty of it, lots of things like automated A/B testing backlogs, rather than investing in things like, you know, traditional SEO, we spend a lot of time building templates, building content that we know will continue to get links every month for the next few years. So we often don't do campaigns. We don't really like the idea of campaigns where you do something today, it gets a bunch of links or gets a bunch of traffic and then does nothing for the next 3 years. We like to kind of, you know, deploy content, release content that is just going to drip feed, you know, results over time. We had a really interesting case study that really hammered this home for us, where we have two sites that are very similar to each other. One is called Broker Notes, the other is called Marketing Automation Insider. Completely different industries. One's in finance, one's in the marketing automation space. But fundamentally, these sites are basically the same. It's like a comparison site that helps traders find the best broker to trade with or marketers to find the best marketing automation software. Fundamentally the same site. Whereas with Marketing Automation Insider, when we launched it, we published, I think, like 3 or 4 pieces of content that it was kind of like a report on the industry. It had lots of statistics, lots of charts. Whereas Broker Notes, we never really did that. And so we spent over the past like 2-3 years, we spent a lot of time trying to grow Broker Notes and doing a lot of marketing campaigns, one-off campaigns to try and ramp up the traffic. Whereas Automation Insider, we basically spent no time over the past 2 or 3 years working on it. And yet both of them grew at the same rate. And it was really frustrating because we were like, we're spending all this time on Broker Notes and it is growing, like it's growing fast, but it's growing at the same rate as Marketing Automation Insider. And it was because of those 3 or 4 pieces of content that we posted when we launched Automation Insider that they were just getting links every month, like from sites like Salesforce, IBM, HubSpot. These guys were all linking to us every month. And so it was just growing our SEO traffic on autopilot. And so this was where this idea of growth on autopilot came from. We're like, right, we want that to be the case for every venture. We want to, when we launch it, publish a few things that will enable that venture to just grow automatically over a long period of time.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I think that this is great because a lot of people talk about content marketing and quote blogging as a great way to share your authority and value with customers or potential customers and get new leads in SEO. And I think 5 years ago, that probably was definitely the case. Now, I think the model is changing to where people are using content either as a place to drive things like Facebook traffic to, or these big guides and resources that are huge, big evergreen pieces that are link worthy, steal a Seinfeld quote, kind of link worthy from these big institutions, whereas it like just a regular 1,000-word blog post might not be. Is that kind of how you guys are viewing this?
Yeah. So we sort of have two sort of formats that we quite like. One is the sort of the guide based format where we create generally, we'll spend like more than 40 hours on that. So that's the kind of general rule of thumb we use. If we spend less than 40 hours, it's pretty easy for a competitor to replicate it or make it better. So we have that kind of that side of things. We might do one of those every 3 months or so, where we really invest a lot of dev time, a lot of copywriting time into creating something that is really special. And then the other side of it that we quite like to do is to think about massively scaled content. So we do a lot of things where we'll launch maybe like 2,000 pages to answer a certain problem. So for example, on a website like Broker Notes that helps traders find a broker to use, we launched, I think it was about 7,000 pages comparing broker A versus broker B. So we created like a list of, say, like the top 200 brokers, and then created every possible permutation of broker A versus broker Z, broker A versus broker S. And this created this list of about 7,000 pages that we could launch. And we tend to do that in quite a lot of different instances. Like we'll sort of figure out like what data would we need to create thousands of pages that would be genuinely useful and help people solve a long tail problem. So they're the kind of like the two general techniques we sort of try to use. One is that sort of we invest a lot of time into creating something really big, really special, very kind of bespoke, and a lot of kind of time and effort goes into. And then the other is the sort of the, with our engineering hats on, the kind of more automated, massively scaled content approach.
Sure, sure. Have you seen one be more successful than the other? It sounds like they both take a large amount of time, and it's not something you do every day. But do you see one being more successful in terms of getting leads and converting them to customers?
I'd say they both kind of serve slightly different purposes, and I'd say in tandem they work well together because. The big guides work really well in terms of attracting links, making the site kind of appear as an authority. Like it's a really, for marketing automation insider, for example, it's those big guides that typically get us the, you know, the really valuable links to the site and allow the site to grow very, very rapidly. Whereas the scaled content approach is just, it just gives the site volume. It allows the site to rank for a lot of things. And so we've never really tested one or the other. We've always sort of tried them in tandem. But you're absolutely right. Both of them take a lot of time. And I'd say the massively scaled approach only really works if you can get your hands on a lot of interesting data. And in some industries, that's harder than others. For Leadformly, for example, it's much harder for us to get, you know, significant amounts of very interesting data. So with Leadformly, we tend to focus a bit more on the big guide-based approach, just because we it would be very difficult to launch, say, 2,000 pages on leadformly.com to rank for lots of long-tail terms.
Sure. Makes sense. Kind of going back a little bit to, I guess, business structure and your philosophy and approach to managing multiple businesses. Can you talk a little bit about a little of the day-to-day and organizational structure that you have in place to manage so many people on your kind of core teams? You have like 5 people on your core team and then like 30 freelancers or developers or contractors. Like, what do you guys use to stay in touch and project management? And kind of what's your stack look like there?
Yeah, so I guess the first caveat is we're constantly changing this and we're still in the process of
They all suck, right?
Yeah, it's a never-ending process to test this. At the moment, our approach looks very, very similar to Basecamp's, which is we work in six-week phases. So we never know what we're doing any more than 6 weeks in advance. So we work in a six-week phase where at the start of the 6 weeks, we decide what we're going to do that 6 weeks. And then we have a two-week break at the end of that six-week phase where everyone is kind of invited to just spend time polishing what you've worked on, work on new innovations, new ideas. That's kind of like there's no scheduled work in that two-week period. And then we kick off the next six-week phase at the end of that. That's worked really well for us. Previously to that, we worked in 90-day phases. So we just kind of worked with the quarters. But we found that didn't really work because by about day 45, there were so many new things that had come to us that we were looking at our plans, thinking, geez, like this is so out of date already. And generally, like you'd spend the first 45 days doing the things that are the, you know, have the highest impact, the highest yield. What we're kind of curious about possibly trying next is working in even shorter phases where we divide the teams into kind of innovation teams and we haven't really come up with names yet, but kind of like an innovation team and then like a general team. So the general teams focus on kind of things that are going to have an impact this quarter or this year, whereas the innovation teams focus more on kind of the next ventures, big kind of ideas that won't have any immediate impact, but you know, things that are going to help grow in the next couple of years. But in terms of your question around how we sort of structure it and how the SPAC works, we rely pretty heavily on a couple of tools, Slack, Basecamp. Basecamp is basically our to-do list of you know, where everything sits and where we will agree on what we're working on. And then Slack is just the day-to-day communication between the team. But yeah, that's the general sort of approach. We have like the one year kind of plans and goals, and then that's broken up into KPIs, and then the KPIs are then split into the 6-week phases.
Gotcha. Yeah, I've been reading a lot of what Jason and DHH have been writing about how they work lately with Basecamp, and I think it's great. I mean, they've definitely been doing it long enough to know firsthand what works and what doesn't work, and in particular about the 6-week, I don't want to say sprint or cycle. I like that they have the 2 weeks afterwards to kind of cool down and let people have some fun and work on things that they want to, maybe really work on bugs and polishing things up, like you mentioned. That's great. I mean, I think it's something we're looking at doing maybe on a monthly basis. So like a 4-week sprint and then a week off or something like that. Because I agree. I think it's, for me, it's tough to know what's going to be important even for 6 weeks. I think I can say this is going to be important for a month, but at the end of the month, something else is going to be important. So, I can, 90 days would be for me too long, but I'm kind of a little too ADD for that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, 6 weeks has definitely been better for us, but we're starting to kind of feel a similar thing around like week 3, week 4. Feel it's maybe time to reevaluate the plan and start a new one. So I think it's definitely going to be a bit of a, I mean, we're constantly experimenting and trying to find what's the right time frame for us. My gut feeling is telling me it's maybe a little bit shorter than 6 weeks.
Sure. So Lead Formally is your kind of flagship product. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say it's definitely not in terms of revenue. We have other ventures that do bring in more revenue, but Lead Formally is, for lack of a better way of putting it, it's probably our favorite venture. It's definitely the hardest one and the most interesting and ambitious project. So it's the one that we spend a lot of time kind of focusing on internally, just because it's just hard. It's that, you know, there's a lot of complexities to building SaaS that, you know, just make it quite an interesting project to work on.
Yeah. So I can definitely relate. What do you think makes it your favorite if it's the hardest and not the most profitable?
Very good question. So I think there's a...
Other than you've seen guys like Jason Fried running Basecamp, and it just seems like the greatest thing ever to have a super successful SaaS business.
Yeah, there's definitely that aspect to it of kind of SaaS. With SaaS, there's just this kind of real, in terms of the size of the opportunity, you kind of know, like, if you get it right, if you get the product right and you can get the numbers working and get churned down and all of this, the upside is enormous in terms of what that can mean for the business. And it's just an amazing business model. It's incredibly predictable when you have people paying on a subscription basis, especially if you can get people, you know, willing to subscribe on annual plans. It's a really nice, predictable business model that I really like. So there's that aspect to it. There's this kind of like this big upside in terms of, you know, the size, the sheer magnitude of the opportunity. But then I'd say like there's this huge intellectual benefit to it. I mean, we're in a very fortunate position in that we have all these businesses that collectively mean that we don't really have to worry at the moment about, you know, whether the lights are going to turn off. We've sort of reached a certain point where we have that stable, you know, revenue coming in that we can start to be a little bit more, you know, investing a bit more money into innovations and things that we genuinely find to be interesting. And so Lead Formally is kind of that for us. It's just, there's a lot of things that intellectually just really push us to the limits. I would say that there are some similar things with other ventures. At the moment, starting to do some interesting stuff around machine learning for one of the ventures that is just kind of like, it's just a hard problem to solve. And so it's not so much about the revenue or the impact, but it's just, we just want to solve it. It's just like, we will become better at what we do if we're able to overcome that. And Leadformly is just providing those opportunities on a daily basis. Like, we're having to use, you know, very kind of cutting edge tools for personalization, for testing. And so I'd say Leadformly just really puts everyone on the team quite out of their depth to a point where we're all learning and getting better at what we do, whether that's the design team, the developers, or myself, just interpreting where the business needs to go and how we're prioritizing the product pipeline. There's just a lot to it. And that's really exciting. It's just a very fun project to work on.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I mean, I think SaaS, as you mentioned, I think for me is the reason that it's so appealing is the upward trajectory and potential in SaaS is so big that even if it's harder and riskier and maybe doesn't pay as well upfront because there's development time and customers pay you a little bit over their lifetime, I think in the end, the upside definitely, I hope, should be there that if you get it right, either, you know, the exit or once it's built to that kind of critical mass of doing, you know, 20,000 a month or something like that, that it really gets easier to run. It seems to be the case from a lot of the folks that we kind of talk to and listen to in the space, that once they kind of get that product market fit right and learn how to acquire customers, that it creates that kind of perpetual machine where they can keep adding on to it relatively easily. So yeah, I think it's a fair thing for us to be chasing. But yeah, it is an interesting thing that we are kind of looking at the thing that's the hardest and most difficult and pays the worst, at least up front. But for me, I think it is a lot of those intangible benefits of it as well. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah.
So in terms of kind of your team, you mentioned you have a core group of five or so, and then contractors. How has it been to build up a team of that size? I'm sure you've learned a lot kind of over the last couple of years doing that.
Yeah, it's been really good. I'd say the nice thing is that we've got this balance of it still feels like a nice small business. You know, I get into the office in the morning and it's, you know, three or four other people. And there's this kind of like startup-y feel to that, where you're all in it together. Everything is really kind of agile and moving quickly. Yet on the other side of it, we've got by having this remote team, we've got the bandwidth to prevent any kind of the sort of the bottlenecks that you would have with a four or five person team. So it's really nice that having 30 or so external contractors, we're able to deploy and ship a lot of stuff across the ventures, but still have that kind of scrappiness that comes with having a small team. And so the general kind of idea with how the team is structured is that every person that is employed by Venture Harbor, so everyone on the direct team, is a creator. Like, we are all constantly thinking about new ventures, what we could build, and defining the strategy around, you know, the future of each of our ventures and what we're building. And then the 30 or so contractors are then basically just in charge of turning those ideas into reality. So that's been the sort of the general process behind it. But I mean, as with all these things, we are still learning and still making lots of mistakes. But it seems to be a nice way of working.
Sure. No, that's great. Yeah, I mean, I love that I'm able to have kind of a higher level view of things. And then at this point, we have a really great team kind of across each of our business units of developers and writers and project managers and people on our team to go fulfill the product or develop the features and provide support and things like that. And it's kind of tough though, right? To build up a team like that you have trust in, that is capable of doing this. Because I think this is the unspoken difficult part of building a team and delegating is hiring a person is not hard. Training them is a little hard, but then trusting that you can delegate the work to them and they can do it correctly to kind of the standards that you set out for me is kind of where the theory of building a big team or remote team or any kind of team gets difficult to implement. I don't know. Have you run into that at all, or has it been easy for you guys to build the team up, train them, give them SOPs, and then let them go do their job?
It's been, I mean, I'd say we've been very, very lucky in that the five people on the team at the moment are absolutely incredible. And so that has taken a lot of strain off of, you know, running into those potential issues as they, you know, everyone that is designing those SOPs are, you know, they're very, very capable. And so it's kind of, I mean, I like Derek Sivers' approach of trust but verify. Like, trust, hire people that you can trust that they will do the right thing and that they'll make good decisions, but have a system in place so that you can verify that that is the case. And so I kind of have that process. Like, when I hire someone on the team, hopefully by the time of, you know, if I've hired them, they should have passed all the tests that suggest that they are, you know, they're going to do a very good job at what they've been hired to do. But then it's important to still have that system where you can make sure that that is the case. And so, you know, we have that with, whether it's something as simple as, you know, for a developer, it would just be making sure all that code is deployed on Git so that we can go and inspect it and, you know, tools that automatically check their code for issues. Whereas for a product manager, that might just be, you know, having a system for how they publish briefs and making sure that those, at any time, we can go in and have a look at those briefs. So it's just making that stuff visible and having good systems in place so that everyone knows kind of what they're responsible for. And one of the things that we have in Venture Harbor that's worked really well is every single person in the team has a one pager that basically just outlines, like, these are your responsibilities. And even I have one. So I have one where I have my four or five responsibilities. And then you also have, below the list of responsibilities, you have the things that you actually do. And that's always a really interesting exercise, especially for business owners. If you look at the difference between what your purpose actually is as a CEO or a founder or, you know, managing director, whatever you are, and then compare that with the list of the things that you actually spent doing in the past 2 or 4 weeks, it can be really enlightening to see the difference. Like, for me, it was always funny that, you know, I have this list of responsibilities, which is, you know, things like set the vision for the company, coach the team, know the, you know, the financial position of the company. And yet, under the list of things I actually do, it was like, I picked up the milk.
Right, right. Responding to support tickets and, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a really good kind of way of identifying what you need to delegate, and also for the team as well. Like, if you have your team list out, you know, these are the things that they've done in the past 2 weeks, it becomes really clear for them, you know, what are the things that they did that at the end of the day, let's say you hire a marketing manager, and you're paying them maybe $20, $30, $40 an hour, you can quickly see, based on what they're doing, how much of their time are they spending on things that could be delegated for less than $10 an hour or $20 an hour? And what things are they doing that are worth $100 an hour or $200 an hour? And when you start thinking about, you know, what percentage of your day are you spending in these different brackets, you can then, I mean, that ultimately tells you kind of, are you losing money or making money on each of those hires? Because if you're paying someone $40 an hour and they're spending a lot of their time on $100 an hour tasks, that's a pretty good hire. Whereas if they're, you know, myself included, like if I'm the CEO and I'm picking up the milk and responding to support tickets, that suggests there's something fundamentally wrong and there needs to be, you know, a bit of delegation to solve that.
I'm cringing a little bit because I admittedly am terrible at this. I really am. I mean, I'm on one hand kind of a control freak and on the other hand, unorganized. So it's like the worst possible of every world is I just want everything done and expect it to be, but don't take the time to put the systems and the documentation in place for the people on our team for them to be successful in the roles that we hire them into. So, I mean, this is kind of like the reason I wanted to talk, I think, today is this is an opportunity that I think everyone has, and even someone who's done it as successfully as it sounds like you have, probably have an opportunity to do a little bit better at kind of systems and delegating and checking and doing only high value things as the owner and founder of the company and letting other people kind of take their role and be successful in it. I don't know, but so as you guys have kind of come along in this, anything that you learned along the way that really helped kind of stay true to that model of prioritization?
I guess one thing that has been, I mean, we have a lot of little kind of a lot of sort of rules and sort of systems that we've kind of come across that have been useful. One of them is we often kind of joke that anything you do more than three times, you should automate, which has been really helpful because it sort of, I think part of the culture we have now is, to be fair, it can go too far the other way. Like we try to automate things that really shouldn't be automated, like because we can. Like we're automating things for the sake of it, which is also a separate problem. But that's helped to really identify opportunities for finding efficiencies. Is anytime we're doing something, you're like, you know what, I've done this. This is like the third time I've done this exact same thing. I think everyone in the company now, like when that happens, they have this light bulb moment where it's like, maybe this is something that can be automated. I think when you sort of have that reaction, for a company like ours, where our business is based on the idea that we have to basically be building new ventures, constantly be innovating, that's a really good source for potential ideas for new ventures. And we, twice a year, we actually take the entire team. I say the entire team, it's typically the core team of the four or five of us. We go away, book an Airbnb, and we spend 3 or 4 days just kind of going through those ideas and building little MVPs of ventures and things that would help us improve, automate new things and stuff. So that's been like, they're two things that have certainly helped. I think one, having those little kind of cultural things that help everyone identify opportunities to automate things and delegate. I suppose the other one is, in terms of, there's this big question around kind of like, when should you delegate? When should you automate? You know, what's the right solution for different problems? We actually came up with the idea of eliminate, automate, delegate. That should be the optimal order. In terms of, if you want to make something more efficient, the first thing is you should actually question, do you need to do this in the first place? Like, should this just be eliminated completely? Because there's no point automating or making a process efficient if you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. Example with us being, like, we don't really do meetings. We just decided meetings don't really help. And this is taken from, the Basecamp way of thinking. Another one is phones. We don't have a landline phone number. You can't phone Venture Harbor. And we just decided, like, for us, given that you can't buy anything from Venture Harbor, we don't offer a service, the only people that call us are recruiters, and we would rather just eliminate that rather than make that an efficient process. So elimination is always a good place to start. And then the reason that automation should come before delegation is because it's cheaper. If you want to delegate a task, you typically have to pay a person to do it. And it's often far more cost effective to build a system or some kind of non-human based process to automate a task than it is to delegate that to a person. So we try to follow that process of, anytime we see an opportunity to make something efficient, first question, do we actually need to be doing it in the first place, or is there a better solution instead? And if not, if it is actually a useful thing to do, can we automate it? If we can't automate it, then we look at delegating it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love it. I love it. I mean, I think that especially talking about a couple times a year, one time a year, you guys all go away, the core group, and really evaluate this. It's something I've talked about here on the show in the past. It's just taking some time away. For me, it's sometimes just a walk in the middle of the day, just to get away from the computer and my iPhone and just be able to think. Because I think sometimes we get so in the weeds, and especially maybe someone like myself who's more in the weeds than maybe you are. Because you've been able to kind of rise above the day-to-day stuff in your business a little bit. But I think regardless, just giving yourself some time and some mental space to think and be strategic and really evaluate where you are and everything is fantastic. And so I think that's definitely kudos to you guys for taking some dedicated time away. And those meetings, is it how much of it is productive and working on new things, and how much of it is kind of reflecting on kind of where you are in the business?
So generally we go away for, if it's like a 3-day retreat, we usually spend a day just kind of teaching each other stuff. So a day of it is just learning based. And then a day of it is kind of the more kind of reflective, going through kind of where we've come from, where we're going, what the opportunities are. And then that day also becomes a bit of a planning day where we start mapping out ideas, coming up with what we could do better. And then we then typically have one day that is just completely a building day where we will start. We try to sort of set a challenge of completely building, designing, launching something in one day. Partly because I think it breaks down this idea that you know, businesses are big clunky things that take a lot, you know, months and months to build. We kind of want to prove that we can launch something in a day from scratch. So that's partly just like a bit of a healthy mental shift, I think, just to kind of get that sort of progress over perfection mindset. Getting people to think about what's the smallest version of this that would add value, rather than getting caught up in that whole like, this has to be perfect and it's going to take months to build. But it also just means that we are launching something that when we get back to the office, you know, is going to add value to the rest of our portfolio.
Yeah, that's awesome. So looking across multiple businesses and a handful of years now almost of businesses under the Venture Harbor name, what is kind of like the one thing you've learned that you think has the most impact on where your business is today?
I think the biggest thing is just thinking about just designing it with automation in mind. A lot of businesses start by trying to offer something that will make money or something that will you know, provide a service or a product that other people are willing to buy. And then automation is kind of an afterthought of, you know, once it's working, then automating it. And that's actually not bad. I think that's a really sensible way of viewing it. But with Venture Harbor, what we've done differently, and it's worked for us, it may not necessarily work for others, but for us, we tend to think about automation right from the start. We typically won't invest in any venture if it can't run itself. I mentioned earlier about this idea of you know, we want to be able to leave any venture alone for 12 months at a time. So this, for example, is why we don't really like working with enterprise clients for our ventures, because enterprise clients just make a business not very automated. Like they want to have things bespoke. They want to spend 3 months chatting to you about some crazy, you know, contract.
Clause, right.
So it's just thinking like that. Like for us, we've always gone into these ventures thinking like we need to be able to, at any time, like it should be okay that everyone on the team is on holiday. Like that shouldn't stop the business running. And so we've always designed the businesses from the very start to be completely passive and completely automated. And then, you know, there's this whole, I forget the name of the author, the guy who wrote E-Myth, the whole
Michael Gerber. Office. Yeah.
Michael Gerber. Yeah. Working on your business, not in your business. And that advice is generally sort of directed at business owners, right? Whereas we sort of take that a step further and think, well, we want the entire team to be working on the businesses, not in the businesses. Like, if every single person is kind of, rather than making the machine work, they're actually, you know, tweaking the machine and getting the machine to work better, then wouldn't that mean the business would grow faster? So that's kind of the probably like the biggest and most unconventional thing that we do at Venture Harbor that I'd say has had quite a big impact on how we've grown.
Awesome. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about? Did you want to chat kind of more in depth about LeadFormly and what you guys are doing there, or anything else?
What I thought could be interesting is so you're a part of the Slack community that I recently set up.
Yeah.
On Copilot. I'd be curious to know. You know, you've been a part of this community for a while. Is there anything that you've seen in there that you found particularly interesting that people have talked about that you wanted to dive into a bit more detail?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that the concept of growth on autopilot and running your business on autopilot, not just so that it sustains, but that it can grow, is revolutionary for me. And I have kind of alluded to this a few times that I generally am a bit of a mess and kind of want everything and am too unorganized to actually set people up with the tools and the processes for them to be successful. But for me, the Slack group is fantastic because it's a lot of people in there that are doing the things and are kind of in the place of their business that I would like to be. And a lot of the discussions are, you know, how do you use this tool? How do you set up this process? How have you found a way? Like one of yours recently was, You have filters in Gmail for everything that has the word invoice in it to get filtered and then forwarded on to your bookkeeper, your accountant. Just little stuff like that, I think, is really valuable. And I have my thoughts on Slack kind of generally, but the bite-sized nature of a lot of the things that we talk about in the Slack group lends itself to Slack being a good medium for that, where it's a little discussion here and a little discussion there. You can participate if you want, but it's not like so much going on in these huge complex conversations, so far at least, that missing a little bit of it wouldn't mean that the whole thing is not valuable. So that's been my impression. It's been fantastic so far. Yeah.
Yeah. This is the thing that I'd say, if there's anything I could have done differently growing Venture Harbor, it would have been to have a community like that. Because a lot of, you know, when we were building Venture Harbor and we were building all these automated systems in all the ventures, we were really kind of having to figure it out ourselves. And, you know, there's just not a lot of resources out there for business owners to tactically understand how to automate and systemize their business. There's a lot of strategic big picture stuff, like things like eMyth is a really good example. There's Sales Acceleration Formula. There's a lot of good books that kind of at a very big picture level provide the inspiration, the motivation to build a very systemized business. But then when you get down to the point of actually doing it, actually building these things in your business, at least for myself, like when you get to that point, I was looking around thinking like, okay, where do I begin? Where are the resources? Where's the blogs? Like where's all the stuff that is going to tell me, like, what do I actually do? What does the sales process need to look like? And so for me, I decided to set up that Slack community as a little bit of an experiment, just to see. I wonder if, you know, if other business owners experience this same issue. And I wonder if business owners would be willing to share what's working for them in terms of systems and share that with other business owners. And it's been amazing. I've learned an absolute ton just from some of the bits and pieces that people have shared in there around things that they're systemizing. Because I think everyone looks at automation systems in a different perspective. We have like web development people that are, you know, looking at some of the aspects they systemized from a web dev perspective. We have people from more of a marketing background, more from a finance background. So everyone's got a slightly different take on it, which makes it really interesting. But yeah, it's been great having that. And I'm excited to see it grow over time into a big community of business owners.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that the tough thing with communities, and you've done a good job with this group, is having a high caliber and high quality of people and them not be self-promoting. That's like the two dangers, is getting someone in there who, I don't want to say doesn't belong, but maybe isn't a business owner and wouldn't really kind of be able to relate and support the conversation, or someone who just wants to go kind of drop links to their own stuff. Is the danger there. So it's great that it's been really high quality stuff so far. So that's wonderful. Thank you. Yep.
Thank you.
Cool. So Marcus, for folks who want to kind of check out more about what you're up to in Venture Harbor and Lead Formally, where can they go find you on the interwebs?
So Twitter, LinkedIn, Twitter, I'm Marcus A. Taylor, LinkedIn. Just Marcus Taylor 100, I think. Or of course you can join the Slack group, which is called On Autopilot. If you tweet me or drop me a message, I can send you a link to that. And to be honest, that's probably where I'm most active at the moment, because it's kind of where my head's at, what I'm thinking a lot about. But yeah, that's probably the best place.
Awesome. Marcus, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.